Welcome to the Maya Fashion Magic in Action podcast. I'm Joanne Averson.
And I'm Paul Thornley.
Today we're going to talk to you about something that means the world to both of us, which is dissection. Human dissection, very fascinating, and we want to give you a particular distinction. And that is when you're looking to find out more about the human body and honour the people that have donated their bodies to science, make sure if you are doing the work or applying to do a course or booking to do a course, that you know whether you're actually going to be doing the dissection or whether you're going to be observing pre-dissected body parts, which is called prosection. It's a very different distinction. And it's really worth knowing that in advance, because it's the difference between being in the lab, actually changing the body tissue in front of you and exploring it to find out, which we're going to talk about in a bit, find out the, if you like, the background of why we teach what we teach in movement. But the other is you are observing things that prosectors, or rather dissectors, had dissected already, and they've been put into some sort of preservation medium for you to observe and learn. And please understand that very often, even medical students don't get to see or experience actual dissection. It's becoming less and less possible to have this in different labs. Some places do. We're going to tell you places that do and talk about courses that you can actually join. But other places, you actually go into the lab and you see pre-dissected specimens that have been preserved, and they are technically called prosections. And all of this is done or supervised by clinical anatomists, which are very specific qualifications at a very high level. Unfortunately, they're not what's called a protected title. But when we talk to people like, or go in the lab with people like John Sharkey, who is a clinical anatomist, the difference between that and what I call an advanced dissector is different worlds, right, Paul?
Indeed it is. The likes of John, who spent his whole life trying to understand anatomy from a very different level to the vast majority of us that will ever have to. Surgeons have to go via his stamp of approval, if you like, because of the standard is so high at that particular level. And then you have other people around the world who are offering similar dissection courses, but the standard of knowledge is not as high. It's not as exquisite. And they're more curiosity. And they've just had a lot of opportunities to do it because in their location, the rules are slightly different, a little bit more lenient about who can offer a course to the general public.
Yeah. So all we're saying is not that anyone's better or worse, and whoever you're following, do follow. But please know the difference, because we're also aware of certain courses that are offered as dissection, and they're actually prosection. Yeah. And we just want to make sure that you know what you're letting yourself in for and what you can expect to learn.
Well, there's a world of difference, isn't there, between what looking at something that has been prepared for you, so often you can't touch them, and then the ones that you can, you're told to touch very gently because they've been preserved in a particular way, so you get a particular view of the anatomy beneath the skin, depending on how they dissected it, for what purpose they're trying to reveal, what anatomy they're trying to show.
Exactly.
Rather than us going in there and we be the dissectors and we reveal things or we create opportunities within the particular specimen where you get lucky enough to touch.
And, you know, both Paul and I have considerable hours of experience in the lab, but we still call ourselves happy dissectors because the truth is, it's the inner cosmos, isn't it? And if we were going out like astronauts in an aircraft, where would we start exploring the cosmos? And it's a bit like that when you open up the human body. Every minuscule square millimeter is just so fascinating, isn't it?
I think that's really important. And that brings you back to who you go to and why you're going there. Because a lot of people just want to experience it because they've been told how amazing it is. But they're quite off put by actually having to participate. Yeah. And so some courses you're expected to, and some courses you're just there as a paying observer, as you like. But I think it's really important who you go with on your initial dissection course, because first impressions count. And your first experience in a lab will last with you forever. your first experience of how you're introduced to the lab itself and the protocol that happens within the lab, way before you even touch a specimen or see one. And that really lays a really good foundation and lets you settle in, gives you that time frame to recognize where you are, why you're there, and who you're there with before you ever get to undo the bag and reveal the specimen you're lucky enough to have in front of you. And then before you actually physically touch it, and way before you actually pick up a scalpel and understand the procedures of handling a scalpel, it's a quite serious tool. And in the wrong hands and with the wrong approach, it can have quite detrimental effects on you and the cadaver. But if you're in the right people, they'll guide you brilliantly and you'll do it very confidently. And they'll help you explore your curiosity of where you would like to learn anatomy rather than be dictated to and say, we've got to go through this criteria from A to Z. And I can feel a little bit stale in that environment where you're not allowed the freedom that on certain courses you most certainly get to go explore this amazing thing we call a human body.
But come on, Paul, we're spoiled.
We're very spoiled.
Friends, colleagues, students, co-authors, buddies of John Sharkey. Be really clear here. We absolutely adore the guy, and he's just facilitated such an enormous body of work for us. And I remember my first time, and it wasn't my first time in the lab, it was my first time in the lab with John. And he said, what are you looking at? And I said, well, I'm waiting for you to start teaching. So I'm not here to teach. I'm here to join the dots for what people want to learn. And I was like, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, there's a table over there waiting for you.
Yeah, crack on.
But you're training that group. And I was like, I'm sorry. But it's like, well, you're trained, you know what you're doing. Yeah. I was like, yes, but I'm a dissector, I'm not an anatomist. So I'm sort of looking up at him like, oh my God. And he said, well, find a way of telling the group that are waiting for you that. And I'll never forget. That's why I call him JTB. It stands for John the Baptist, because it was baptism by fire. My God. And what was so wonderful is that we were intrigued to discover how moving one part of the body affects another part. Now, here's where you bump into your first distinction as to what form of preservation that cadaver has been put into. So if it's formalin, you don't get to see about movement because it's locked in rigor mortis. It's stiff in the position in which that person passed and was embalmed. And you have to understand, this is all said with the absolute honor of every single person that's donated their body to science. We say thank you. And we are in reverent awe. I mean, honestly, I think it's more like a sacred environment than it ever is a cold-hearted, purely anatomical situation for me. I've only ever been in that sacred environment, but I work with Todd Garcia quite a lot. And Todd is in America in the Laboratory of Anatomical Enlightenment. And he teaches and treats it as very, very sacred. What was possible when we were working at Dundee University was working with Teal Soft Fix.
Yep.
And I think you had the same experience, didn't you, in Cremona in Italy? And
In Cremona was a fresh frozen.
It wasn't Teal, but it was still Soft Fix in the sense that it was frozen. So it was unfixed effectively.
Correct. Yes.
I will tell you, anyone who's interested, that you can actually have an opportunity this year to work in Cremona with us under John's auspices, and delighted that Andre Pilat will also be there guiding and teaching and talking to us all. What I was going to talk about was the privilege when I first began this journey of working with John, as I said, was that I wanted to see, or we all wanted to see, how this body moved. If we moved the foot, did it affect the shoulder? If we moved the head, did it change something else? And in Soft Fix, you can see that before the knife even comes out.
Well, it's a distinction in John's character. He wants to give you every variable. And because of his endless years of work, he has recognized the different opportunities that lie in different types of preservation for the curious instructor or medical student. So because he's been around the block and he's found the best locations for us and got us access to them, which is just unbelievable that as a movement instructor, I'm allowed to go in and have the privilege of doing this type of work surrounded by such esteemed colleagues and mentors. I mean, we have professors and surgical residents in with us, and we teach Pilates, for God's sake. I just find myself very lucky to be in that room in that, with that particular company. But I think it's very important that people understand that how it's preserved offers a different type of opportunity to dissect things differently. Because I think most people only ever think of it being hard and fixed when something dies, and then it goes, it gets rigor mortis and it goes stiff and it remains in that form all the way through until it's either buried or cremated. And that's just not true, because there are different methods, like you're explaining, of preserving these tissues so that we can explore them differently. They dissect differently. And we get, again, like you say, different opportunities to see how they move more realistically when they were alive.
Mm. And it tells us, I mean, this is where the classic situation comes, that in the laboratory, very often people are very excited. They come in with a theme of, I want to know how the suboccipitals work, or I've got a thing about the psoas. My thing was always the psoas, and how I don't understand why the iliopsoas complex is written off as a unit in the human body, because in my world, it should be the diaphrasoas. So you remember, you and I both had the opportunity to explore that. And I was on my knees with gratitude and awe at the human body.
It's just mind blowing when you actually see the reality of the tissue rather than the perception of your education.
Exactly.
Because we all come from different styles of education, but generally traditional academic is biomechanical and it's set in parts and pieces. Like you learn to read a map.
Yeah.
And like we always say, the map does absolutely not reflect the territory at all. No. I mean, you might look in a similar location in a similar area and you expect to see a certain type of structure there, but on each and every cadaver, it's organized differently. And that's the most remarkable thing. At first you go, well, why are they in different places and why is it traveling a different route? But it's meant to do the same function for each one of us. And that really was a light bulb moment for me. I mean, all that decade ago, that light bulb was like, oh my God, I've got these amazing techniques that I can do with my hands as a manual therapist. And I've got these great cues and repertoire to offer people. But the same set of circumstances does not result in the same outcome with everybody. And why? Because we're built completely uniquely. And to see it, was like, whoosh, like a Christmas tree of lights. Like, yes.
Yeah. Yes. It's absolutely that. And I remember when the first cadaveric dissection I did, there were 3 to 5 bodies available, or cadavers in the room. Yeah. And somebody was talking to me about psoas minor.
Right.
I was like, okay. So we went to look at psoas minor on each of the cadavers. And I think there were 3 psoas minor muscles in the entire laboratory. Right. 2 on one body, 1 on another body, and no one else had one.
Yep.
And it was like, sorry, but the anatomy book says psoas minor. Well, they didn't have one. Okay. And then we were looking at latissimus dorsi.
Yes.
And I remember having this conversation with Thomas Findlay in the foyer once at the
Thomas Findlay. What a nice guy.
God bless him. Amazing man. Amazing man. And we were having this conversation and somebody was talking to me and he was overhearing it about latissimus dorsi. And I said, yes, but it's such a major muscle of variation. Do you know what you mean by that? It was a Pilates teacher, actually.
Yes.
And talking to me. And you are far more than a Pilates teacher. You're a neuromuscular therapist, Paul, and you're a jiu-jitsu master and blah, blah, blah. So let's just be clear that it's a lot more than that. Just saying, because it's necessary. So you're looking for an awful lot more subtle variation and nervous system understanding. But we were still shocked, nevertheless, at what we see, right? And so this person was asking me about latissimus dorsi.
Sure.
And I had actually been training a group of Pilates teachers some years before. And this is a little side story, and don't let me forget to go back to latissimus dorsi and Thomas Findlay.
Yeah.
But somebody in the course earlier, I was up in London teaching a group of Pilates teachers about T12, the magic of T12.
Yes.
And they were talking about latissimus dorsi and blah, 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 blah. And I remember looking up before I went to prepare for the lesson. I was looking up in 3 or 4 different anatomy books, the origin and insertion of latissimus dorsi. And I was like, seriously? Because they were different in different books.
Yes.
And these were back in my early days, we're in the early 2000s. And so I get on the phone to Tom Myers, who was my teacher then.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Tom, it's Joe. All right, what's up? What's the origin and insertion of latissimus dorsi? What do you mean? T9 to the sacrum. So I said, yeah, and the humeral hip, obviously. So I said, are you sure it's T9? And he went, what do you mean? And I said, well, are you sure it's T9? Because it was a fair question to me.
Yes.
And he was like, well, why wouldn't it be?
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. You know, yeah. You're the boss. You know, you tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me go back and look and do a lot of research. It was one of those magic light bulb moments that, again, as you say, lights up a whole Christmas tree. And it sent me down more rabbit holes than I care to count. And yes. So I discovered that latissimus dorsi is one of the highest or most variable muscles in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
So then fast forward to another situation in another large Pilates association. I know I'm a yoga teacher, but I did teach a lot of Pilates groups. And somebody said to me, well, what we do is we teach people to stabilize latissimus dorsi.
Mm-hmm.
And all my alarms go off. And I say, well, do you know where it is? Well, of course I know where it is. It's whatever they said, T7 to the sacrum and that, whatever, the humeral hip. And I said, but you don't know that.
That's right.
So I suggest you don't cue muscles because it can get you in a lot of mess.
Yep.
What do you mean? Well, told them this story. Now, I had a client at that time, and they had a particular movement pattern. They were a Pilates teacher, funnily enough. They were doing my yoga teacher training at the time. And this pattern was very clearly answered by the fact that their right latissimus dorsi
mm-hmm.
was about 3 vertebrae to the humeral head, and the left one was complete, like what you'd expect, all the way down to the sacrum. And it became very clear that latissimus dorsi could simply be a band
yep.
that actually had an attachment of sorts to the scapula, the shoulder blade,
yep.
and then went where it's supposed to go, to the humeral head. So I'm back in this foyer of Ulm University with Thomas Findlay answering this Pilates teacher who's asking yep. me, and I'm like, careful what you say about latissimus dorsi and any other muscle in the body, my darling, because latissimus dorsi is a muscle of high variation.
Mm-hmm.
And Thomas Findlay looked at me and he said to this other person, don't worry about it. It's only about 15% variation. Don't be concerned, to this teacher. And I turned on him. And I wasn't being disrespectful, but it's just a voice saying something to me. Didn't know who he was. And I went, excuse me? And he said, it's only about 15% variation. You don't have to worry about it. And I said, excuse me, it's not the same 15% variation. With all due respect, Dr. Findlay.
Yep.
He had a badge on, so I knew what his name was. I said, with all due respect, Dr. Findlay, 15% variation amongst human bodies is not the same 15% in all human bodies. Indeed. It doesn't mean that there's 15% variation between people's latissimus dorsi. Dorsi. I don't know what the plural of dorsi is.
Dorsi.
Whatever, with two eyes. Whatever. Just being at it. And he looked at me and he went, what made you say that? And I thought, oh, and he did a presentation a couple of months after that on the muscle variations of the human form. And it was fascinating.
Yes.
So that was my kind of segue into a non-hierarchical way of, oh my God, everyone's a shock.
Well, it wasn't much a shock. It was like, thank God I'm not mad, because it makes sense. If we look completely different on the outside, how would we expect to look the same on the inside? And because I've learned all my anatomy from John Sharkey, I went with him first. So this language and this approach was really already my bedrock of understanding of human movement, because I had to go find these tissues and implant them somehow. And trying to have x-ray glasses on when you're trying to look through skin is a skill hard earned. And I'd earned a good set of eyes, but my palpation was, again, as good as it was. It was transformed once I saw underneath, and it gave me the license to go, nothing is where you expect it to be. There are no origin or insertions.
Mm.
I got told, go look for one. If there's over 620 of them, go find one of them. And I was like,
And well, there's supposed to be 1,200 of them, because if there's a, well, if there's an origin and an insertion, every muscle's supposed to have two attachments.
Correct.
Right? Give me a break. Where are they not attached?
Well, exactly.
Find me one that's not.
Well, it's not that they're not attached. There's just no separation. And to create one, and we can all create it with our imagination and a scalpel or a pencil and a piece of paper. But when you actually have to do on a living or a dead form, you have to sacrifice things. You have to sacrifice things to create it. And that, for me, made everything. How I learned anatomy from then, how I taught it and shared my knowledge with people, it changed how I explained what was happening beneath the skin and what we were meant to interpret, not take for granted. It was brilliant.
And it made sense, did it not, of the body reading that we do, whereby we, like, I remember once I had a client who was dean level of anatomy at a medical school.
Yes.
And it was a client. So I'm like, I've got to body read this person. And I'm going to be really honest with you. It was in my younger days as a structural integrator. And I was absolutely terrified because I thought, oh my God, if
you're
he asks me a question about, like, exactly. If he asks me a question about my anatomy, I better get it right kind of thing. I was reading my anatomy books the night before the session because I thought, oh my God.
That's right.
And he didn't. I was body reading him in his, you know, gym gear and stuff. And I just sat there and I said, did you play an instrument? And he went, sorry. I said, did you play an instrument? Let's say it was a violin. It wasn't, but let's say it was. And he said, yeah, I played the violin for X years when I was a teenager and I played professionally and for many, many years.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, okay. And of course, immediately I had my shape template that I knew that the breathing pattern was biased to, the head position was biased to, the arm movement was biased to. And I never, ever forget as long as I live that, you know, he just looked at me joking, teasing me. He went, all right, prof, because he was prof. He knew I knew that I wasn't. I was like, oh, I said, I'm terrified of working on you because you're going to test me on my anatomy and I don't want you to. He said, no, that's not my job. My job is to not be in pain.
Yes.
Okay. So he goes, all right, prof, what's your verdict? And I just stood there. I'll never forget. I just was terrified. And I said, I think you've got violinitis.
Violinitis.
He went, I'm sorry. I said, you've got violinitis. He said to me, oh, God. And he put his hands like, what on earth are you talking about? And I mean, I'd been in the lab with him. I'd been in the anatomy lecture theatre with him. He'd let me come in with his medical students and take me tour. I mean, oh, my God. And I'm standing there and I said, look, I'm really sorry. I was blushing. I said, I'm really sorry, but I could actually take photographs of you now and draw in where the violin's present is missing.
Yes.
That your loving, growing, career-based shape-shifting.
Yeah.
To become one with your instrument and play at the level that you played is writ large in your connective tissue matrix.
Exactly.
And I think it's wonderful. I'm not criticizing you, but unless I undo some of it, we ain't going to get your spirals spiraling so that you can swim like a dream in the pool.
But that's what it does, isn't it? Once you've seen beneath the skin and you can appreciate the different variations of densities and thickness and formations, we then stop trying to make people symmetrical. We've stopped trying to make them the same all the way around, like a robot and mechanic and the mechanical referencing. And that's why I always say there's no such thing as a bad posture. It's just moving inefficiently. You just have a bias to a certain shape. It's taking you to a negative threshold where it cannot continue to adapt on your behalf any further. And now you end up with some sort of dysfunction or inhibition. And as somebody who helps people, it's so, I mean, I'm not trying to be big-headed, but it is really easy to read somebody's life through their form and their fabric of themselves.
But where else are you going to read it? Exactly.
Well, but you have to understand that for where we come from, you're meant to look at these bones should be here. There's an expectation of where they should go and why I'm taking them there. And once you remove that constraint of education and that limitation of opinion, and you can use your intuition and you use it based on experience of seeing these cadaver specimens, you can really do true magic with people, and they're wondering how you did it and why you're not a doctor and you don't have the big letters after your name. And that's because I didn't end up in that particular vein of education. I went the other way, where I was allowed to let my curiosity flourish, if you like. And I was allowed to question the academics because I wanted to understand why they were saying it the way they were saying it and why I was not experiencing it in a clinical environment. And then we had a different conversation. And I was able to have those conversations because I'd seen inside a cadaver and many cadavers. And I'd seen the variations that were there. And I'd seen the outcome of me applying those views and that learned education on my living pliers as I tried to incorporate what I'd seen and why those that had transpired, they had gone that way internally, so I could help people prevent it happening. Because you can anticipate outcomes in people once you see the outcome of it in a cadaver. I think they're brilliant.
Just so well said. And so this year, we're so picked to be in Cremona in Italy again with John. Well, again for you. It won't be again for me because I didn't make it last year. I was in America.
It was very lovely last year. It was amazing. You went and got your doctorate and abandoned us. And it was fabulous. And if you like Italy and Italian food, it's a brilliant place and venue to go. It is in one of the more rural areas, just outside Milan, about an hour. It is a spectacular little town called Cremona with the most amazing restaurants and lots of nice things to see, but it's not inundated with tourists. So it has this almost like a little township atmosphere. So it's a nice place to hang out. And from there, you can travel all around Italy up to the Lake Como or go further down south if you wish. But in the lab there, it is truly magnificent. And we were so lucky to have this fresh frozen types of specimens. And John, as always, brings great lectures. Last year, we had Carlo Stecco, who was clearly magnificent. Yeah. And Mark Ellis, the neuroscientist, he was also incredible to listen to and work with.
Well, we had the pleasure of working with him in Ohio, didn't we?
That's right, yeah.
I did make. And that will be again this year. So there's another opportunity for those of you listening in from America to work in Ohio this year with Peter Friedel. And wow. I'm so excited about that because he's done such brilliant research on fascia and very meaningful for any of us doing body work, particularly those of you who are massage therapists, because of his research paper on effects on cancer. And it's massively important work. And I know he and John collaborate a great deal. Where appropriate, they know each other well enough to support each other's work. And I think it will be a fabulous platform for both of them.
The presentations alone are worth the visit and the trip. I mean, they are literally spectacular, the level and standard of these presentations and the generosity of information they give you. And because it's such a small group, maybe 30 to 40 would be a large group there, sometimes a little bit smaller, you get that personal attention, you get that intimate dialogue with these people, and they cannot share enough with you. And they will sit with you for hours talking about whatever troubles you're having or whatever misinterpretations you've got, or to clarify your approach of your own style and modality. They're really generous. They're super involved. As just a normal punter, like I'm not a scientist. I'm not in the medical profession. But to read these slides and make any sense of them, they just look like colorful paintings. But you have these absolute diamonds of the industry, geniuses, reading them to you and explaining what we're looking for, why we're looking at it, and what anomalies there are, and what are the spectacular outcomes of this particular approach. So it was just, we were very lucky.
And on that note, we will make sure that there's details in the show notes for you of how to do two things. You can go to ntc.ie, click on dissection, and you will be able to join the Ohio dissection or the Cremona dissection in Italy, depending on whether you're in Europe or you're in America or you're lucky enough to be able to do both. If you can take the chance, I think I can honestly say it will totally transform whatever you teach.
Life-changing experiences.
Yeah.
Enjoy them.